Who were the Jews who fought back during the Holocaust? It's a little known story now coming to light. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my conversation with Dr. Wolf Gruner, the 2025 Recknick Holocaust Speaker at the University of Southern Indiana. Dr. Gruner is an author and professor at the University of Southern California and is an acclaimed scholar on the Holocaust and genocide. Dr. Gruner will share his research into the resistance of ordinary Jews in Nazi Germany. Joining the conversation is Dr. Todd Schroer, chair of the Criminal Justice Department at USI. The crime orchestrated by Hitler and his henchmen was the murder of 6 million Jews. 2 Main Street is next on WNIN-FM, presented by the Berger Wren Group at Baird Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. History, of course, can be a great teacher. Learning not to repeat mistakes made in the past, there's power in that, and knowing what others endured should ensure a better future. A speaker series at the University of Southern Indiana focuses on a human tragedy in the not-too-distant past, the degradation, persecution, and eventual extermination of millions of European Jews, the Shoah, the Hebrew name for the Holocaust. The horrors of the Holocaust remain a stain on humanity, and we still ask, how did it happen? And fear something so terrible could happen again. There's power in knowing the past, but the fact is the powerless continue to face an uncertain future. The late Irene Recknick established the Edward D. and Regina Recknick Holocaust Speaker Series at USI to honor her parents who survived the Holocaust, were in the camp, the Auschwitz-Birkenau camp, where nearly a million Jews were murdered during World War II. As a child, Irene spent 5 years in hiding, survived the Holocaust, reunited with her parents. Eventually, the family moved to Evansville. It's quite a story, and we'll talk about it later. But now, let's introduce my guests on 2 Main Street. Dr. Wolf Gruner, a native of Germany, is the latest speaker in the Recknick Lecture Series. Dr. Gruner is an internationally acclaimed Holocaust scholar and is the chair in Jewish studies at the University of Southern California and is the director of the USC Center for Advanced Genocide Research. Dr. Gruner's latest publication is Resistors, How Ordinary Jews Fought Persecution in Hitler's Germany, and that's the headline of the latest speaker series. Joining the conversation is Dr. Todd Schroer, associate professor of sociology and chair of the Criminal Justice Department at the University of Southern Indiana, with specialization in social movements, extremist groups, the Holocaust, and genocide. So, gentlemen, after that long intro, welcome to 2 Main Street, and Dr. Gruner, of course, welcome to Evansville. Now, before we talk about the Jewish resistance, both of you can tackle this question. Can you both give us an idea why the Jews were targeted after World War I? How did that happen, Dr. Gruner?
Yeah, so
that's a big question.
It's a big question. The story actually goes longer, goes into the 19th century, because Jews were kind of underprivileged in Germany before 1871, when they got equal rights. So this was very late in the game, and it meant that they were discriminated against before in all kinds of, let's say, all spheres of the society. And only after 1871, they slowly could be, for example, in areas which they had normally no access to, like universities, for example. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time when this happened, small kind of groups started to kind of mushroom, who developed these anti-Semitic kind of feelings towards the Jews because of their success, because of their integration. And these groups later, after the First World War, became, let's say, more widespread, but also in the beginning they had targeted students, and these students were now leaders in kind of post-war Germany. And so this kind of anti-Semitic ideology in a way got more kind of footholds in certain parts of the society, of the German society. the kind of attacks were on that they were too powerful or become too powerful and that they want to take over the German society or have already taken over. And so these were the accusations. And there was this contradiction that in reality they were a very small, tiny margin of the German society.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Gruner, you're a native of Berlin. What's your family history in World War II?
Oh, okay, good question. So my father and my mother, they came from the southern parts of East Germany, Saxonia, and a region between Saxonia and Thuringia. One of my grandfathers was kind of a teacher. Actually, both of my grandfathers were good teachers. So they became members of the National Socialist Teachers Union, which was one of the strategies of the Nazi Party to kind of, in a way, establish strongholds in all different spheres of society by creating specific Nazi organizations. So you had kind of in the judicial system, you had a Nazi organization, as you had also in education. And so they became members of National Socialist Teachers Association, not members of the Nazi Party. And then they both went to the war, but pretty late because teachers were a little bit kind of like their drafting was postponed. So they entered the war. One was just in Germany, kind of, and the other one was in Italy in the occupying force.
Now, you're not Jewish, so why study the Holocaust, Dr. Gruner?
It's kind of a personal story because I grew up in East Germany, that means behind the Iron Curtain. In East Germany, I experienced quite a lot of, let's say, racist attitudes among the East German population, also xenophobic attitudes. And I started being interested at the time I was having this was even before I studied under kind of history as an undergraduate. I was a poet at the time and it was interesting how people feel, what they think. And so I started to read about racism, and the only explanation I got at this time was there needs to be a state-sponsored ideology. And this was modeled a little bit from by the Holocaust history, right? That the Nazi state was persecuting the Jews. But the problem was in East Germany, the state actually operated very differently. They kind of proclaimed that everybody is equal, workers of the whole world unite, there needs to be solidarity with Asia and Latin America and Africa. And so you have the policy, which is anti-racist, and then you have people on the ground behaving racist. How do you explain this? Mm-hmm. And this is why I decided to leave poetry and go into history.
Okay. All right. Now, Dr. Schroer, you're not Jewish either, mm-hmm. So why did you study the Holocaust?
I ended up following a very circuitous route, kind of like Wolf did. I studied deviant social movements, and I studied a lot of the white power, white supremacist organizations for a very long time. Teach a class on hate groups, and there's a section on there on Holocaust denial. And I realized my students couldn't argue against the denial arguments. They couldn't respond to them because they didn't have enough information or just schooling about the Holocaust. So I started to seek out how to teach the classes and then started to kind of go down the Holocaust wormhole before I started to kind of switch now to genocide more recently.
The Holocaust denial, I cannot believe that's still around.
Mm-hmm. A lot of it's more diminution or trying to, you know, diminish the impacts. So they'd say like, oh, it wasn't 6 million, it was 3 million. Or they'd make other comparisons like, well, there's the firebombing of Dresden that occurred. So there's atrocities by all groups of people. The very few people anymore say it didn't happen at all. So it's much more diminishing the impact or the what happened.
But we still have neo-Nazi groups, don't we?
Oh, yes, definitely. But they are permutations from what real Nazis are. So some examples of this is you see in the U.S. there are people that are Polish or that are Slavs that are neo-Nazis, and Hitler would have slaughtered them.
Sure.
They were thought to be subhuman. And so it's very interesting that people are taking on these ideologies that they would have not been happy with in the past.
But. Mm-hmm. All right. So the Rechnik Speaker Series, how did that come about, Dr. Schroer?
As I said earlier, Irene Rechnik wanted to honor her parents. They had survived Auschwitz-Birkenau and the death marches afterward as well. And she had a very, you know, unique story of being a child in hiding. And what's phenomenal is that they actually were reunited afterwards. And so she just wanted some way to send that message forward, to keep it alive, what happened to them and the atrocities that occurred.
I think it's interesting that I've done some research on that myself. And her father, I think, was the manager of a coal mine or something like that. And he managed to get one of his co-workers, who was a Catholic, to take her, Irene, in as their child to shelter her. Mm-hmm. So that's part of her hiding.
Yeah, it's
so she had to assume a new identity, yeah. The so-called hidden children, right, Dr. Gruner?
Yeah, and this is also not so unique. It was more widespread than we actually thought. There are new studies in in Germany about what makes people actually help, right, and rescue. And interesting is that on the one hand, what we can assume, it's personal relationships. If you know somebody, right, then mm-hmm. they are more likely to help. But then interestingly, they found out that when you are directly confronted with somebody who seeks help, so somebody knocks on your door, you don't know the person, and they ask for help, then you are more likely to help. That's interesting, the direct situation. Mm-hmm. I think there are more studies now on people who helped, and we often underestimate also the amount of, let's say, of people who actually helped. So for one person hiding, in this case, it is one family because it's a child. But if these adults, it's much more difficult to hide them. Mm-hmm. So there are studies 10, 20 years ago in Germany that up between 1 and 23 people are necessary to help somebody survive within Germany. Because they had to survive for several years, right? When the deportation happened, this was like 1942, 1943. So until the war ended, they had 2.5 years to go. And they could not stay often in one place, so they had to switch, to move to other places. So more people were involved, actually, in help.
Now, Dr. Gruner, in a previous work, you researched the groundwork for the Holocaust with the rise of Adolf Hitler in 1933, a series of laws designed to strip Jews of their wealth, status, and power. And I think they began with the Nuremberg Laws. Is that correct?
Let's say this was the most influential,
okay.
Because but it's also misunderstood because people take it for that it stripped German Jews of their citizenship, which it actually didn't do. It stripped them of their political influence because the Nazis created kind of a two-tier system, which were Reich citizens, where only Aryans could be Reich citizens, and they had all kind of, let's say, political possibilities. That means they could vote, they could be voted on. And Jews in the second tier, who were the old citizens, so to speak, they could not vote and they could not have political influence. So this was very influential, but it was not the beginning. The beginning was actually much earlier. It was started right in 1933. And what I think is really important to underline, it was not always coming only from Hitler. A lot of my studies, which I did earlier, were actually on the local level. So municipalities were the first ones introducing anti-Jewish legislation, so to speak, like by city council decrees. And they started with cutting business ties to Jews, let's say, who kind of provided services for the municipality. They dismissed city employees as the first ones, like employees and also workers. So there was no law, let's say, by the German government or the Nazi government. So this is a process which goes over the next years. And interestingly, I called it a mutual dynamic mm-hmm. between local initiatives and central kind of laws. And often we see that Hitler actually picked local initiatives and then transformed them into laws. So for example, segregation in hospitals started on the local level mm-hmm. and then was introduced in 1938, so 5 years after the Nazis started to come to power. Mm-hmm. So there is this kind of, it's really, we have to think in a different way. It was not like this top-down dictatorship mm-hmm. where everything happens sure. from the top. There's a lot of kind of anticipation. There's a lot of initiatives on a local level. which actually helped to establish this kind of not only the dictatorship itself, but also especially the persecution of, let's say, perceived enemies, and the Jews were one of them.
So that helps streamline the persecution, definitely. And you talk about the boycott days, curfews, limited store hours, licenses revoked, taxes and fees imposed, access denied to public buildings, and of course the wearing of the yellow stars. And you even had a law forbidding Berlin Jews from owning pets.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, and it was actually one of the... It's not really well investigated yet, but there was a law in 1942, or a decree, that Jews were not allowed to have pets anymore. So they had to give up their pets. And one of my questions was always, so what happened to these pets? And there's not really good investigation, but I did some a study which was not on Germany, but on the former Czechoslovakia, on the Czech part of former Czechoslovakia, the so-called protectorate Bohemia-Moravia. And there I found out what happened to the pets, because they introduced the same at the same time there. So they were given to kind of pet shelters, like animal shelters, and they then sold them to Aryans. So they, because at first we also thought maybe they were killed or so. No, they just sold them and made a profit off them.
Okay, all right. Now, Dr. Schroer, today social media has become a tool to spread conspiracy theories, falsehoods. How did the Nazis spread their propaganda? I know Dr. Goebbels was the key to that, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, they actually had a ministry of propaganda. I mean, they were very blatant with it. And you have to realize how much innovation was occurring in this time period that Goebbels brought about. You have, you know, of course, blockbuster movies that, you know, Reichstahl, right, had been creating, like Triumph of the Wills and things that were cinematic things. But they also controlled the radio, and they had special, very inexpensive radios that they passed out to people in society, so they would get directly Hitler's messages or other ranking officials. They also would create, like, albums. But then a lot of the information is coming through like newspapers or pamphlets. And so some of them, like Der Stürmer, is a very anti-Semitic newspaper, but that would be widely acceptable or seen because they would have big glass cabinets for people to go, like at a bus station, I guess, yeah, train station things. So kids, anyone could be able to read it without having to pay for it. And they, like it, that Wolf brought up earlier, they start to take over everything. So all of, to be a journalist, you had to be part of the union. So they got rid of all the existing unions and they made Nazi unions or organizations. Same thing they did with children, like got rid of Boy Scouts and Hitler Youth and things like that. So they had complete control and you had to say, toe the Nazi line or you would lose your job or that newspaper would be taken.
So there was no free press then?
Oh.
I mean, it's interesting that you asked this because for a long time there was still kind of there were still newspapers which were not Nazi newspapers, but the problem was that they often kind of in anticipation, kind of in a way obeyed to the Nazi propaganda and or didn't challenge it, and so people in diaries you can sometimes read or in letters or in also kind of post-war memoirs that there people would still read in local newspapers, which were not Nazi newspapers, but they would transport increasingly a lot of the messages what the government wanted or didn't challenge. And that's, I think, the main problem is when you have independent newspapers, if they don't challenge government propaganda, then they are complicit and actually support what's happening. And also, another method was when you would go to the cinema, because there was no TV at the time, before the actual movie, and it could be a really non-political movie, you would have newsreels,
right,
like you had in the United States. And these newsreels were highly kind of orchestrated and to convey the message of the government. But I would add, while propaganda was really important, one should not isolate this because it also needs to be accompanied by certain policies which are kind of have a social impact. So what I think is often underestimated is how many opportunities the new regime actually provided for especially young people. So one has to kind of remember that there was a big unemployment because of the world economic crisis. So the kind of, we talked earlier about the changing of institutions. This also meant creating new positions for especially young people. And so just to give you one example, the municipalities were usually represented by different organizations all over Germany. Smaller community, like municipalities, big, they had their own organizations. In May 1933, like a few months after Hitler took power, they created one organization, which was called the German Council of Municipalities, which kind of, in a way, unified them, but by force. And then the head of this organization became a 29-year-old, like, loyal follower of Hitler, who had not big expertise had in this kind of area of municipal policies. And he was, in this young age, he was leading not only a kind of a institution in Berlin, which was kind of the headquarter with 200 employees with no mandatory experience, and then all the branches all over Germany. So thousands of people were kind of under his management, and he was young. So you can imagine policies like this, in a way, make people extremely loyal. Yeah, even if they may disagree in some parts with some of the policies, if you get these opportunities, you are always thankful, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this, we should not forget, this is across the board over time, from the truck driver in Austria who kind of became working in Auschwitz-Birkenau, where he got like triple the income what he had as a truck driver. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are across the board opportunities. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, my guests are Dr. Wolf Gruner. He's the Holocaust scholar at the University of Southern California and the 2025 Rechnik Holocaust speaker. And Dr. Todd Schroer is here. He's chair of the Criminal Justice Department at the University of Southern Indiana, which is hosting the speaker series. So the coming up, we're going to find out how ordinary Jews fought back as they faced persecution and death in Nazi Germany. Some interesting stories there. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guests are Dr. Wolf Gruner, a native of Germany and a Holocaust scholar at the University of Southern California. Dr. Gruner is the 2025 Rechnik Holocaust speaker at the University of Southern Indiana. Joining the conversation is Dr. Todd Schroer, chair of the Criminal Justice Department at USI. Now, there is an Advanced Center for Genocide Research at USC. So, Dr. Gruner, tell us about that. How did it start and what goes on there?
So when I kind of started to think about the Holocaust, I often wondered, how is this comparable? Because there are ideas that the Holocaust was a very unique historical event. I was always seeing also parallels that, for example, in other historical mass atrocities, that people start in similar ways to discriminate against people, which in the end results in like mass atrocities. So I had the idea to fund a kind of found a center where one is enabled to do this comparative work. And in the beginning, it was an agreement with the Shoah Foundation, which went in 2006 to USC. The Shoah Foundation houses today 60,000 video testimonies of survivors of the Holocaust, but also of other genocides, like the Guatemalan genocide, the Cambodian genocide, the Armenian genocide. And so the center was supposed to do kind of the academic work for the Shoah Foundation and to enable research, especially with the video testimonies, because they hadn't been at the time really used by scholars for research. They were mostly used for, let's say, high school education. Mm-hmm. So long story short, new kind of leadership in the Shoah Foundation had other priorities, which led to kind of a separation between my center and the Shoah Foundation. Today, my center is an independent institute at the University of Southern California. Practically, we do the same work as we did before, which is twofold. One is to promote the video testimonies as an incredible, important resource, which changes our view in many regards, and I can illustrate this later, how we see why are people kind of committing crimes and how these crimes impact populations. The other thing is, from the very beginning, I was lucky that the center received some donations for fellowships. So my center is practically, I think, the only international center which has fellowships researching comparatively, let's say, genocide, including the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. So we bring in every year 6 to 8 fellows from PhD students to senior scholars who work with the testimonies on very different topics. Yeah, and we enable this and support this research. We mentor these, especially the young scholars. This is what also is really rewarding for me as a kind of a scholar and mentor. And then we have a similar like kind of speaker series where all our fellows have to present. And this is kind of, these are since COVID hybrid events. So we now have an international audience from which reaches, interestingly, from South Korea via Dubai to Italy. I mean, so it's interesting. People are interested in these topics, and we can really learn a lot from these comparable kind of comparable views on these different events of mass atrocities. So, for example, today we think about what happens in Sudan, what happens in Congo, what happens in Myanmar, what happens in China, right? What happens in Gaza? So there are kind of multiple events where we think these are systematic. Events of systematic mass atrocities against the people. And I think the problem with the genocide definition is the threshold, first of all, it's a legal definition. It's mm-hmm. not. This is different from what we as scholars operate on, because for us, it's a kind of vehicle for analysis. But in legal terms, you have to prove a certain sure. conditions. And one of the hurdles is that intent needs to be proven. Mm-hmm. However, when you think about the Nazis, even the Nazis, there is no document signed by Hitler, I will exterminate the Jews. All what we have are different documents which kind of give us the idea that this is planned and that this is happening. So in a way, it diverts really the attention which we need to pay, that people are attacked on a massive scale in their human rights, in their livelihoods. And I think this is what we should care about.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the United Nations Commission on Genocide, that was in 1948. The UN recently has gone on record claiming there's been genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. That continues to be debated. And we talked about other groups that are targets of genocide. So let's go back to Hitler's Germany now, 1933 to 1945. Dr. Gruner, you talk about 5 areas of Jewish resistance. What are those 5 areas?
So yeah, first, it's interesting we have to talk about what is Jewish resistance. And our traditional view was, first of all, there was not much. This was because we focused on resistance only as groups, organized events, mm-hmm. and then they are mostly supposed to be armed. And this is then referring to, for example, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising of 1943, partisan activities in the occupied East. We now know that there was also way more partisan activities than we ever thought. But this kind of, in a way, reduced our views. And what I try to do in my research is, first of all, shift the focus from the occupied East, from Poland and the occupied Soviet Union, to Nazi Germany proper. And then to kind of broaden the definition and say every kind of act which is kind of in a way challenging the regime, we have to take as a kind of act of resistance. And I do this because all my sources are sources that the Nazis punished these people for their acts, which shows that they were perceived as a threat.
Right.
And when they were perceived as a threat by the Nazis, we should call this resistance, right? Mm-hmm. So what I when I started with this premise, which really changed my perspective also as a scholar, then I suddenly, I found hundreds and hundreds of different acts of resistance. And to make sense of them, I came up with these 5 categories. One is challenging Nazi propaganda. We talked earlier about Nazi propaganda. So, for example, I found evidence that Jews ripped down Nazi flags, that they destroyed Nazi anti-Jewish posters. They besmeared these displays of the anti-Semitic newspapers, right? So this is one category. The second category, which was the most widespread, was actually public protest. And this was surprising because we thought nobody spoke out mm-hmm. In Nazi Germany, especially among the Jews. And then we see that hundreds of Jews were actually arrested and put on trial for criticizing the Nazi government, individual kind of laws, like you mentioned the Nuremberg race laws. They were criticized by people in public. Violence, like the Kristallnacht. They were, people spoke out in restaurants, on the streets, in their neighborhoods, in offices. And many were punished for this, if they were denunciated. Third one is written protest. So for example, which writing letters against the persecution, petitions, but also anonymous leaflets or anonymous postcards with kind of calling Hitler names, all done by Jews. And then the last two are also, the one is, let's say, very widespread because it is disobeying Nazi laws and decrees. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the decrees which impacted Jews were done on the local level. So it is also challenging those, not just the laws of the Nazi government. So it is practically from reaching from sabotaging forced labor, which they had to, which they were recruited for, or not wearing the yellow star. You mentioned this, this as a, which we thought is a kind of a not a really important thing, but no, they were actually punished with jail sentences if they did not wear the star. And then the last one, which is the most surprising one, was actually physical self-defense. So from teenagers who defended themselves physically against like verbal insults or physical attacks in school, in their neighborhoods against Hitler Youth or neighborhood kids, till like men who beat up stormtroopers, like because they harassed like a neighbor and so on. So interestingly, these instances were never really looked at and show a very different picture if you take it all together that we can actually can say that many Jews did not take this like passively. There was no passivity among the Jewish population in Germany. And what I found really important also to highlight is it was not just men. It was actually a lot of women actually rebelled against the persecution.
You have one, I think, example of a lady sitting on a bench that was marked only for Aryans, a simple act of defiance. I'm curious about the feedback from your students learning about all of this. Dr. Shore, what's the reaction from this generation nearly 100 years after the Holocaust? Are they shocked? Are they amazed? Or did they know about this?
Well, sadly, they know very little about it.
Really?
Some states do have, you know, mandatory. They have like one lecture a year, or some places actually a little bit more than that. It's become farther and farther away from anything that's related to their worlds. And so that's kind of something difficult to overcome. So I mean, this is a problem, but I try to Americanize it a little bit when I talk about the Holocaust and talk about eugenics in the U.S. as well as eugenics in, you know, there, or the miscegenation laws that exist in the U.S. at that time that the Nazis kind of modeled at least some of their laws on. Really, to be honest, there is not that much interest. Sometimes I try to teach my Holocaust class and I can't even get 10 students to sign up for it.
Dr. Gruner, who were the Mischling?
Oh, so the Nazis, in a way, tried to come up with a race definition of Jews, and they had a hard problem because they could not actually come up with some. Like they tried to measure, they tried to all kinds of things to do kind of a whole scientific research on this, but they couldn't. And so in the end, they resorted to the religion as the marker, which so they introduced with the Nuremberg, after the Nuremberg race laws, the idea that you are Jewish when your three out of four grandparents are Jewish. So if two of your grandparents were Jewish or just one, then you became a so-called Mischling, which is a kind of a hybrid. And there was one problem for them. There were attempts among the, let's say, the SS to include them in the fully into the persecution. But since they had non-Jewish relatives, the Nazi state was aware that this might create problems. Mm-hmm. And so they were not fully included in the beginning in the persecution. Only during the war, more and more measures were taken against them. So interesting fact is that these Mischlinge, they had actually to serve in the German army still until 1940. So they invaded they helped to invade Poland because, so it is a very difficult decision, history. But in the end, they ended also up in forced labor camps, for example, in 1944, so right before the end of the war. So although they had German or non-Jewish relatives.
So this whole obsession with blood purity, that's what I thought that was very interesting, that the Nazis were so obsessed with that. Wow. And, of course, things were bad and getting worse for German Jews in the 30s. And then when Germany finally went to war, the Jews seemed doomed, didn't they?
Yeah, but this is not so clear-cut and not like a very kind of a clear path. It is, I think, a series of failed kind of policy attempts. So, because first, the Nazis really tried to drive out the Jews with by any means. First, with like, there was violence against them, boycotts, as you mentioned, very early on in 1933. Then with laws like the Nuremberg race laws. Let's say in 1938, they realized all these measures are not like really expelling the Jews because they are clinging to their homeland. They have built something. They contributed to Germany. So many didn't want to go. And so that's actually where then Kristallnacht comes in, where this was a kind of a massive violent attack onto the whole Jewish population within Germany. And we often, and this is my next book actually, we often thought this was an attack on synagogues and shops. Mm-hmm. That's how it's known, how the public understands this. But my new research shows that the core of the Kristallnacht was actually a massive attack on Jewish homes. And if your home is attacked, destroyed, then you kind of lose any rest of his security, because many Jews kind of resorted to their home as the last refuge. So this then kind of increased the immigration after Kristallnacht tremendously, but still many Jews could not leave because they didn't have the money. Many countries closed their doors, so they got stuck in Germany. And so one aim to the Nazis started to think, how can we get rid of these Jews if they got stuck with us? So the first plan was to deport them to Poland. But then in Poland, there were even more Jews when they invaded Poland. So they created more and more problems with every occupation. And this is when then more and more kind of ghettos came about. And then in the end, it led to mass murder.
Tell us about the final solution. What was that? When was that decided?
So the final solution is the Nazi term for the kind of extermination, annihilation of the Jewish population of Europe. It is difficult. There are scholarly debates when this was decided. So there are, on the one extreme, people say, oh, Hitler always wanted this. The counter argument is, why would then he kind of try to drive the Jews out of Germany? Makes no sense. And the other extreme is, it was kind of a decision last minute. And I think the war was a decisive factor here. And one of the reasoning for the beginning mass murder is not so well known, because we think about the mass murder only in terms of Auschwitz mass murder in extermination camps. But the mass murder actually started on a large scale in the occupied Soviet Union as kind of massacres on gunpoint. And the argument was that the Jews are behind Bolshevism, and they, to kind of secure the hinterland of the German army when they invaded the Soviet Union, we need to get rid of all the kind of dangerous elements. And the Jews were perceived as the one of the most dangerous elements. Mm-hmm. And from first massacring the men, then the idea was, oh, the women support the men, the children will become future men and partisans.
And we'll seek revenge.
So we'll seek revenge, so we will kill them all. Mm-hmm. And this is how actually the Holocaust really started. Mm-hmm. And then later, these extermination sites were established.
All right. Now, Dr. Shore, of course, you're head of the Criminal Justice Department at USI. Talk about a crime. This is a crime of humanity, mass murder.
Definitely.
So it should be viewed, I guess, as a crime.
Oh, definitely. I mean, and it's one of the issues you have as Wolf brought up, is that there's legal terms for all of these, and some of them are more made up, like ethnic cleansing and things. But
this is murder.
Oh, definitely. And
premeditated murder.
Oh, definitely. And in terms of coming at it from criminal justice, you're passing laws. Because, I mean, almost everything that the Nazis did, they had laws or decrees that allowed them to do that. You have judges that are interpreting the laws. You have law enforcement that is basically enforcing the laws, rounding people up all across many nations. And then you have the correctional system, which is anything from, you know, concentration camps, death camps, to a variety of other kinds of regular existing kinds of prisons and things. So it very much overlaps with the criminal justice system, which is how kind of one of the reasons I ended up there. But it definitely is a horrendous crime.
And they had special courts, I understand, set up just for these the people that would violate these laws.
The special courts were established as a tool by the Nazis to go after their political enemies, because they were especially enforcing a law of 1934 against so-called treacherous attacks against the Nazi state and the Nazi party. We always thought this was actually aiming at communists and social democrats, and we should not forget that these were communists and social democrats were the first victims of the Nazis. They ended up first in concentration camps. So we always thought the special courts would kind of bring in these communists and social democrats. And my research showed that because Jews also spoke up and criticized the regime, they equally ended up in these courts. So these are not regular courts. They and so we understood that they were, the prosecutors were often Nazis. They were often also highly anti-Semitic. But they were still part of a legal system. And we should not underestimate that the Germans inside Germany, this is different in Poland, but inside Germany still cling to this kind of idea of a legal system. And so judges would kind of judge in the terms of the law they applied. And so interestingly, sometimes people ask me, so when Jews spoke up, they were thrown into a concentration camp. No, they weren't. They ended up kind of being arrested, put on trial, and then whatever the outcome of the trial was, they ended up in prison or in a penitentiary, but not directly in a concentration camp.
Were there juries involved?
No, the system is a little bit different in Germany, so there are not, like in the U.S. system, people's juries. There are judges, and so you have a prosecutor, you have judges, and that's how they decide.
My guests are Dr. Wolf Gruner. He's the professor, author, and Holocaust scholar at the University of Southern California and the 2025 Recknick Holocaust speaker. Now, coming up, the message, never forget, as we look at the Holocaust and the continuing struggle between the powerful and the powerless. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guests are Dr. Wolf Gruner, Holocaust scholar at the University of Southern California. Joining him is Dr. Todd Schroer from the University of Southern Indiana, which is hosting the Recknick Holocaust Speaker Series. Dr. Schroer, you chair the Criminal Justice Department at USI. These laws imposed on the German Jews from 1933 to 1945, it made them, made the citizens criminals. And we talked about those special courts. So would you say the outcomes were predictable?
No. In many ways, I mean, Hitler and the Third Reich, they're pushing the envelope continually and kind of waiting and see what they can get away with. And so they're pushing it very far. And you have to realize, in terms of the laws that are being passed in the system, within roughly 3 months, Hitler has complete legislative power. And so he, anything he says becomes actual law in the society. So it was very easy for him to engage in these things. So
now, Germans, of course, kept extensive records. Now, you were able to find German police reports of incidents, adding to research. What was that like, going through all those files, Dr. Gruner? Tedious?
Yeah, I think in some way, innovation comes from hard work. So you need to go through thousands of files. And this enables me to sometimes come up with also challenging views. And just to add to the last part is, it is not that when Hitler has power, that immediately the judicial system and the courts totally change, because the judges are often from pre-1933. That's mm-hmm. one. Second of all, there are differences between local courts, like regional courts, and then federal courts. And the local courts are, for quite some time in the 1930s, often, in some instances, actually have verdicts in favor of Jews. When Jews, for example, file for that they were dismissed from work with no reason. And so they had success, but then often in the higher levels, it was kind of thrown out. And then in my research, for example, I found that even in the 1940s, during the war, there were acquittals of Jews. So Jews who spoke up against the regime were actually acquitted. So, which we never could imagine, mm-hmm. because we thought, oh, this whole system is against the Jews and everybody works against it. But judges had certain leeway within the law. And if the witnesses were not reliable, or there was a good defense, or they were in some way sympathetic, the outcome could be different. But talking about the sources, this is really, on the one hand, the hard work, but also the joy, because you discover these things. Mm-hmm. And the whole beginning of this work on Jewish resistance was coincidence. I was just before I came to the United States, I was sitting in a Berlin archive because I wanted to look at one source which I knew existed. I had worked with it before, but I had never the time to really go through all of the materials. And these were police logbooks from 30 police precincts in Berlin between 1933 and 1945. So this means the diaries where the policeman writes, I arrested a drunk driver, or there was a bicycle stolen. And I had worked with this for a tiny portion of 1943. So I wanted to go through all of them. Before I moved to the US, I knew I need to do this because I won't have the time when I'm living here. So I went through this, and there was this one, I mean, there were thousands of handwritten notes about exhibitionists, about, as I say, damage to kind of property. And then there was this one note, arrest of a Jew for public protest, called political incidents. And I thought, this is strange. I worked for a long time on, let's say, all different aspects of the persecution of the German Jews. And I was not aware that this actually happened. And this kind of intrigued me to a great degree. Also, it kind of in a way resonated with me personally because, as I said, I grew up in East Germany. I grew up in a dictatorship. So I know how much courage it takes to speak up publicly against the regime. So that Jews would do this, who are kind of in a way double kind of discriminated against as regular citizens and as Jews, in a way really struck me. And this is the beginning of then a long journey of like 10 years of research, and ended up in this book.
I thought this was very interesting too. You've worked with the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And the police order of 1939 for German Jews to identify themselves either as Sarah or Israel?
Usually we know that the Nazis obliged the Jews to carry these additional kind of middle names to identify them. Because we talked earlier about like how the Nazis tried to kind of come up with a racial profile, and they couldn't. They could not identify Jews, right, in public, for example. And so that they had to adopt these middle names was a vehicle to identify them. Interestingly, I assumed, as many scholars, the Nazis obliged them, the Jews would do this, and that's it. However, the German law about names requests that you, when you want to change a name, you have to apply for it. So when the Nazis came up with this order, this was not automatic. Every individual Jew, man or woman, had to go to the police station, fill out a form, pay 3 Reichsmark to kind of trigger the change of their names by law. And interestingly, many Jews just didn't do it, which I was also not aware of before. Mm-hmm. And here it comes some interesting in, usually we think about resistance as done by young people. Most of those who rejected kind of the request to change their law, their names, were actually elderly people. It makes also sense because their whole life was connected to their names.
Sure.
So to get a discriminating name to carry was much harder for them than for an 18-year-old. Much evidence that they resisted. And then when they were identified, that they rejected this, they had to, they were also put on trial, and they actually received prison sentences.
Another form of resistance, as we talked about. This slogan, never forget, reminding the world about the Holocaust so that it should never happen again to anyone else. I'm sure that's a slogan that is repeated often, maybe at your center and at these conferences.
I think interesting is when, since we work so much with the video testimonies of survivors, really what struck me is that many of the interviews I have watched, that at the end, the protocol says, the interviewer has to ask, do you have any message for the world? And in many instances, the message of these Holocaust survivors is, it should never happen again to anybody. Not just us.
Sadly, as well, there are genocides occurring all across the world right now. So that it doesn't seem if it's never again, it seems like it's again and again.
I think what often is kind of brought forward is, as the Germans did after 1945, we couldn't do anything, right, against what happened. And also today, in many, let's say, countries, people think, oh, if there's some authoritarian government evolving, we can't really challenge this. We have no power to do this. And I think the story of these Jews in Nazi Germany, how they resisted, is actually showing us everybody can do it at any in any circumstance, at any time. If they are capable to do it under these the most kind of obstructive regime, let's say in modern history, then anybody can do it. And this creates certain also responsibility that you should do it, that you should speak out, you should challenge authoritarian kind of developments. I think that's what I would say as a message.
Gentlemen, thanks so much for this conversation. It's been very enlightening. Thanks for being my guest on 2 Main Street.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
2 Main Street on WNIN-FM airs Thursday at noon and Saturday at 11. Previous shows are on demand at WNIN.org. 2 Main Street is presented by the Berger Wren Group at Baird Private Wealth Management.